Throughout most of Japan's automotive history, there were two companies in the lead, Toyota and Nissan. Everyone talks about Toyota. They're the unquestioned giant and the champion of Japanese cars. But what about Nissan? How did they come about? Well, the history of Nissan Motors is a fascinating reflection of a world-famous industry. In today's video, the rise and first death of Nissan Motors. But first, I want to remind you about the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first with selected references. It really helps a lot. Videos that do well with the early access crowd tend to get sequels. So I deeply appreciate your feedback and support. Thank you, and on with the show. Nissan Motors' origins date to the 1910s. The family tree is exceptionally messy, so bear with me. Back then, a few enterprising Japanese dreamed of building a car on Japanese soil, but most failed, producing a single prototype before vanishing, because of the dominance of imports from Europe and America. Until 1911, Japan had just 43 domestically produced cars, the imports numbered over 600. People kept dreaming, however, and one of those people was Masujiro Hashimoto, a mining and ironworks engineer. The Japanese government sponsored him to go to the United States to work at a steam engine plant. Upon returning in 1911, he started a small company called Kaishinsha Motorworks. The company did car repairs and assembled import kits like those from Swift Motors in Coventry, England. But all the while, Hashimoto dreamt of making a Japanese automobile, and he turned to three financial backers to fund that dream. The initials of their surnames, Kenjiro Den, Rokuro Aoyama, and Ketaro Takauchi, gave the car its name, DAT, which in Japanese also means escaping rabbit or very fast. The DAT came out in 1914, and its basic 2-cylinder 10-horsepower design was inspired by Coventry's Swift car. The car wins a bronze prize in that year's Taisho Exposition, and six more models were released until 1917. However, in 1920, Kaishinsha hits financial difficulties. Hashimoto designed a truck in an attempt to save the company with military orders. The truck is ready by 1924, but those orders are meager. Deep in the red, Kaishinsha liquidates. Its military business then merges with another early Japanese car company called Jitsuyo Motors, founded by an American who immigrated to Japan, William Gorham, to form DAT Jidosha Seizo in 1926, and I'll just call them DAT Motors. Gorham had a side business as a consultant engineer, and his best client was the business tycoon Yoshisuke Aikawa. In 1930, Aikawa and his company Tobata Casting purchased a majority share of DAT. With that, Hashimoto left the company he founded, and he later reflected, "My life ended with sowing seeds. I sowed the seeds and nurtured them, but I could not reap the harvest." He passed away in 1944 at the age of 68. DAT's new owner, Aikawa, was raised in a prestigious but impoverished family, and the experience seemed to instill in him a drive to succeed. Trained in mechanical engineering at the University of Tokyo, he first worked at Shibara Engineering, a workshop founded by the famed inventor Tanaka Hisashige, the Thomas Edison of Japan. Many years later, Shibara will merge with another company to form Toshiba. What happened to them after that, I covered in another video. In 1905, Aikawa traveled to rural America to apprentice in an iron factory. After returning to Japan, he founded the Tobata Casting Company in 1910, producing cast iron fittings for foreign car makers. Tobata did not exactly set the world on fire, but Aikawa was smart and driven. In 1928, a few years before acquiring DAT Motors, Aikawa was asked by his ailing brother-in-law to take over a failed mining company called Kuhara Mining. Kuhara owned Japan's second-largest copper mine, the Hitachi Mine, but the company fell apart in the economic recession after World War I and the Great Kanto Earthquake of 1923. They were on the verge of bankruptcy. Aikawa turns the company around and restructures it as part of a new publicly held holding company called Nippon Industrial Company, or Nissan. Then, in September 1931, the Japanese military staged an explosion as a pretext to invade and occupy Manchuria. This ignominious event as well as a move off the gold standard that December, caused Japanese stocks to plummet. Aikawa took advantage of the crash by scooping up depressed shares on the cheap to form a new conglomerate, the Nissan Zaibatsu. By 1937, they would control 77 companies, the third largest conglomerate after Mitsubishi and Mitsui. But let us drive back to Little Dat Motors. In 1930, the Japanese government issues a new regulation stating that driver's licenses were no longer required for cars with engines under 500cc. So, Dat Motors pivots to making mini cars with the aid of Gorman and engineers hired from the United States. Their mini car hits the market in 1932 and is called the Datsun, as in Son of Dat. The name is later changed to Datsun with a U, since the son in Datsun, as pronounced by a Japanese, meant loss, as in financial loss. Being competitively priced with contemporary imports like the British Austin 7, 1,150 yen versus 1,600 yen, it does well. But then, the mushrooming Japanese war effort in Manchuria intervened. The military needed trucks, and the country was importing them at an unsustainable cost of 40 million yen each year. So, in 1932, a government committee designed a standardized domestic truck called the Isuzu and searched for business partners to help build it. The established Zaibatsu, like Mitsui and Mitsubishi, were uninterested. The business class were largely critical of the military's aggressive actions. So, the government gathered together Dat and two other small car companies, Ishikawa and the automobile division of Tokyo Gas and Electric. I know, Tokyo Gas and Electric had a car division. Who would have thought? When it became clear, however, that the three were each too small, Dat merged with Ishikawa in 1932. But Aikawa apparently wanted the merged company to make more than just cars and trucks for the military. He wanted to make passenger cars. And fortunately, he still held the rights to make and sell Dat and Datsun cars. So in 1934, he took those rights and founded a new company called Motor Industries. This was then rolled into the larger Nissan Zaibatsu and renamed to Nissan Motors. Nissan Motor produced one of Japan's first automated production lines in Yokohama. In 1935, they made 3,800 units and started exporting to Australia. That was good, but Aikawa believed that to compete, domestic companies needed annual production of 10,000 to 15,000 cars, and they still fell short. Nissan Group harbored yet another valuable connection. Aikawa was distantly related to Japan's conservative wartime leader, Nobusuke Kishi. Powerful and extremely controversial, Kishi is the grandfather of the late Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. They are not too fond of Kishi over there in China. Anyway, in 1936, Kishi, urged on by Aikawa, passed the Automobile Manufacturing Law. The law not only forced the domestic production of automobile parts, it also granted Nissan and Toyota a license monopoly on car assembly operations in Japan. General Motors and Ford, their biggest competitors, were limited to just 12,360 units and 9,470 units. This essentially forced all the American car makers to try and strike agreements with Japanese companies. Nissan struck a deal with the American car maker Graham Page, buying the technology to build a car called the Nissan 70. Then in 1937, Japan formally entered into war against the Republic of China. The military government centralized control over the Japanese economy and compelled production of fighting trucks. Datsun and Nissan passenger car production ended in 1938. In December of that year, Aikawa had a plan to defuse looming tensions of war between Japan and the United States. He moved Nissan Group's headquarters to Shenqing, capital of the Manchukuo puppet state, changing their name to Manchuria Heavy Industries. His goal was to raise billions of yen to promote development in the puppet state, creating binding economic ties between the United States, Japan, and Manchukuo. Negotiations between Nissan and Ford on a possible technology transfer partnership also continued. But Pearl Harbor ended both efforts. When war broke out, Ford's Japanese people burned their documents before being jailed. The government seized the American carmakers' factories, equipment, and land for a nominal sum. After 1941, Japan's wartime efforts shifted from ground operations in mainland China to naval efforts in the Pacific Ocean. Frustrated, Aiko had left Manchuria for Japan in 1942, and Nissan and its company shifted to producing engines for planes and torpedo boats. Post-war, Aikawa's closeness to the military government and his role in the occupation and exploitation of Manchuria led him to be labeled a war criminal by the American occupation. Nissan Group was dismantled by the occupation, and Aikawa removed as chairman of Nissan Motors in 1945. He was imprisoned for over a year before being released. After that, he does not return to Nissan, but instead goes into politics. He never held a particular interest in Nissan Motor. After the war, Japan's automobile industry laid in ruins, with shortages in everything from raw materials to capital to equipment and so on. A faction of the government led by the Bank of Japan advocated for letting it go entirely. The governor of the Bank of Japan, Hisato Ichimada, said in 1949, "It is meaningless to develop the motor vehicle industry in Japan. Now is the time of international division of labor. As we can get inexpensive motor vehicles of excellent quality from the United States, why don't we rely upon them?" MITI disagreed, MITI of course referring to the Ministry of International Trade and Industry. They believed that a vibrant car industry stimulated other parts of the ailing economy like machinery and steel, as well as brought in foreign currency and prestige, stating, "Our country is one of 12 countries that produce passenger cars. These countries, except one or two, all are strong industrial countries. It is clear that in order to produce passenger cars, a country's technical and industrial standards must be at a high level." To nurture the domestic car industry back to health, MITI proposed restrictions on foreign imports using commodity taxes, the careful allocation of foreign currency, and of course, high tariffs on foreign car imports. The Bank of Japan opposed this. The Ministry of Transportation was not against it, but felt imports were necessary. But the outbreak of the Korean War and growing demand for passenger cars that followed convinced people that car imports were not sustainable. The high tariffs were crucial in protecting the Japanese car industry. Japanese-made cars were nowhere near competitive. MITI themselves estimated the industry at 20 to 30 years behind. In 1952 Japan, an 8-cylinder Ford made in America cost just $167 more than a tiny Toyota Toyopet. But the Japanese car industry seemed to lack thankfulness for this. As they developed and grew, the industry became rather resistant to taking further quote-unquote guidance from MITI, perhaps to the latter's frustration. In 1950, Nissan and Toyota shared the Japanese automobile industry, together holding nearly 75% production share. But the entry of new competitors like Mazda, Mitsubishi, Honda, Fuji, and Daihatsu had eroded their grip on the market. And then for Nissan in particular, the company was struck in 1953 by a major labor dispute. Workers demanded 20,000 yen a month based on their calculations of a market basket. Being twice the average university graduate salary then, Nissan could not afford such a raise. So the strike went on. In these days, Nissan had two major economic allies. The first was Hitachi. Nissan bought their electronic components from Hitachi, and Hitachi bought a lot of Nissan cars. I am unable to confirm if a Nissan-built engine powers their Hitachi magic wand. Their second ally was the Industrial Bank of Japan. For decades, much of Nissan's loans were made by this bank, and the bank, in turn, garnered much of its profits from this client. So in the early 1950s, the bank lent to Nissan one of its executives, Katsuji Kawamata, to lead their accounting division. As the strike dragged on, Kawamata was assigned to defuse it. During negotiations, he makes an alliance with a small independent work group of college graduates. He encourages those guys to form a second union, the Nissan Motor Company Labor Union, and together they break the old union's hold over the workers. Kawamata's actions formed a new, very cozy arrangement between Nissan's management and its union, with major consequences down the line. But for now, it cemented Kawamata as the president of Nissan Motors. Inside the company, they called him the Emperor. The labor strike allowed Toyota to surge ahead of Nissan for the first time in the post-war era. So to catch up, Nissan cooperated with the British Austin Motor Company on the Bluebird passenger car. Foreign expertise helped make the Bluebird a success with taxis and rental cars, and it remained their core offering for many years, driving Nissan to 66,000 cars made in 1960. Nissan first entered the American market in the late 1950s. They felt that Americans would be interested in buying Nissans as an economical second family car. They showed off their small Datsun 1000 at the 1958 Imported Motor Car Show in Los Angeles. Famously, Toyota exhibited their flagship Toyopet Crown car there at the same show. The expensive car flopped in the market as it lacked the power or stability to handle America's open roads. They withdrew shortly thereafter. Nissan's cars sold a little better, but can't have been called a success at the time. But Kawamata is determined, and in 1960 they established an American subsidiary to sign up dealers and help service Datsuns. A year later, they had signed up 122 dealers. The Toyopet's flop caused Toyota to withdraw from the United States, leaving Nissan alone in the U.S. for several years. By 1970, Nissan had sold over 170,000 Datsun cars. Nissan also began their first forays into other regions at this time. In 1957 and 1960, they began exporting their own knockdown kits to Taiwan and India, partnering with local companies for the assembly. They also sent kits to Latin America. Mexico was a valued market, and they built their first real factory, called CVAC, in 1966 there. The lessons learned from that helped with future expansions in North America. Then came the 1960s, a time of growing national income for the Japanese. Richer Japanese wanted more cars, and demand boomed. In 1960, MIDI estimated over 1 million unit sales a year by the end of the decade. In 1965 alone, sales hit 1.8 million. Moreover, tastes were shifting towards larger, more powerful cars with engine capacity of 700 to 800 cc or higher. Such cars included the Toyota Publica in 1961, the Mazda Carol 600 in 1962, and the Mitsubishi Colt 1000. Here, Kawamata misstepped. Nissan's most popular car at the time was the small Bluebird. Kawamata was afraid that making these larger, more powerful popular cars, as they're called, would cannibalize Bluebird sales, so he prevented their development. This misstep allowed Toyota to surge ahead in passenger car market share with the Publica. Nissan scrambled to get back in the game with a model called the Sunny, but low volume put them on their back foot. In steps MIDI. Fearing oversupply, they had been, throughout the 1960s, trying to convince Japan's eight or so car makers to consolidate. They tried to merge the smaller ones into a third player alongside Toyota and Nissan, and they tried to forbid Honda from entering the industry, though Soichiro Honda is so based he doesn't care about that. But anyway, it was in that spirit of consolidation that MIDI suggests that Nissan merge with the struggling car company Prince Motor. Prince dates back to two pre-war aircraft companies. When aircraft production was banned after the war, the two started making cars. They first made an electric car, which was well received, but the Korean War boom caused them to switch to gas-powered trucks. In the late 1950s, Prince drew on their aircraft heritage to release a series of high-performance cars like the Skyline and the Prince Gloria. But intense competition and a weakness in sales and marketing left them with poor revenue, large inventory, and rising debt. So, Prince's president reached out to various merger partners through their bank. Toyota turned them down, smelling a raging dumpster fire beneath the covers, but Nissan saw Prince as a way to get back into a category in which they were behind, and with MIDI's mediation, negotiated a merger in 1965. The merger had some upsides and downsides. It brought the company into a brand new world of high-performance sports and racing cars like the Z-Series and the Nissan GT-R. But at the same time, the merger also planted the seed for future troubles. Prince indeed had many problems, and adding sporty cars to the lineup might have delighted the world's car heads, but it stuck out like a sore thumb in a company that produced Bluebirds. And merging the labor union set the stage for even more serious problems. Nissan's labor union, working hand in hand with management, demanded that Prince's labor union close. This preserved labor peace, but essentially made the Nissan union a member of management, with bad consequences in the future. The growing focus on emissions, starting with the Muskie Law of 1970, followed by the oil crises of the 1970s, sparked massive American demand for smaller, more economic Japanese cars. The American car makers were forced to develop new, cleaner running engines, which cost money. Then inflation in that decade triggered rapid wage increase clauses for union workers, worsening their cost basis against the Japanese. After a second oil crisis hit in 1979, the Japanese automobile company surged ahead of the Americans with cars like the Datsun 210, which could go 41 miles on a single gallon of gas. Nissan leaned into the environmental message with slogans like, "Drive a Datsun, plant a tree." And the notion worked. A third of all the cars sold were Japanese small cars, and nearly 2 million cars were being imported each year. Japan became one of the world's top car-making nations, but the export boom caused major geopolitical tensions. A political agreement in 1981 negotiated a cap on Japanese car imports, forcing the Japanese to move production abroad. While investigations for a U.S. plant were being done in the mid-1970s, based on learnings from their Mexico plant in the 60s, it was not until April 1980 that Nissan announced their first American plant in the city of Smyrna, Tennessee. It was completed in 1982. Nissan's new president, Takahashi Ishihara, then pushed the company into a massive globalization drive that saw them opening factories across various other countries. In 1984, they announced that they would open a plant in Sunderland in northeast England. This plant remains open to this day, producing cars like the Leaf. The company also struck cooperative deals with local companies in Spain, West Germany, and Italy. Nissan's seeming success in transplanting their practices came as a surprise. How can a Nissan factory in the US and Europe still be so productive? Business scholars talked of the company's unique hybridization strategy and ability to create togetherness across cultures. But then came the 1990s, a time of reversal for Nissan and the other Japanese car makers. Every year from 1992 to 1998, Nissan turned losses, except for 96. The popping of the real estate bubble deeply damaged the company's home market. For the eight Japanese car makers, profits in Japan fell from a peak of nearly $12 billion in 1989 to $4.2 billion in 1992, a two-thirds loss. One major issue was that Nissan, like Toyota, simply had too many of the same cars. Japanese consumers wanted cheaper cars or migrated to minivans, SUVs, and recreational vehicles, RVs. But Toyota ably responded, while Nissan failed to keep up with the trend, either producing too many of the wrong cars or too few of the right ones, causing the latter to be too expensive. In 1990, Nissan sold 1.38 million cars at home. By 1998, they sold just 861,411. And the appreciation of the Japanese yen laid waste to the company's bottom lines. In 1993, Nissan saved 150 billion yen by consolidating parts, but then gave back nearly half of that in currency losses alone. Overseas, Nissan's aggressive globalization strategy became a drag. Operations in Spain and Mexico started losing money, and in the United States, the Big Three bounced back with new products and a refocused effort on productivity. How the turntables turn. Nissan did no favors for themselves by undertaking an expensive, controversial, and confusing brand change from Datsun to Nissan in the 1980s, costing hundreds of millions of dollars. Kawamata later regretted naming Ishihara as president of Nissan, seeing the globalization move of the 1980s as being driven by politics rather than economics. Ishihara wanted Nissan to be a model for other Japanese car makers and pushed ahead as the guinea pig. And finally, The company's years of acquiring and assimilating technologies and businesses to accomplish its goals had left it with a high cost structure and unproductive workers. Dealing with such a complex structure was complicated by its relations with its union. Over the decades, the Nissan Labor Union, once so cooperative, had created almost a system of dual management that left it with a bloated, unproductive workforce, particularly at home. Worst of all, the company's heavy debt balance, a load estimated at $22 billion, hung over them. The company attempted to save itself with a series of restructuring plans. The first plan in 1993 involved one of its first ever Japanese plant closures, the Zama plant, and the elimination of 5,000 jobs. It was their second oldest plant, now far too old and too small to be useful. The suburbs of Tokyo had basically expanded around them, but it still took 2 years to actually close. In 1997, Nissan's North American operation started seriously deteriorating from an aging lineup. Things came to a head the following year, May 1998, when the stock market crash damaged the company's portfolio of shareholdings, forcing management to seek the help of a foreign partner. That year saw many consolidations. The biggest was the merger between Daimler-Benz and Chrysler Corporation to form Daimler-Chrysler. Nissan negotiated with Daimler-Chrysler and then Ford in the hopes of a partnership, but those fell through. Finally, in May 1999, the company signed a deal with the French carmaker Renault. Throughout the century, Toyota and Nissan took wildly different approaches to their business. Toyota is an engineering-led organization focused on producing popular cars with their own internally developed technologies. Nissan, on the other hand, was different. They were led by bankers and administrators. They bought and assimilated foreign technologies as needed and exhibited a haphazard management style that frequently caused them to fall behind on the latest trends. And out of all the big Japanese car makers, Nissan was the one closest to the government's industrial policymakers, so much so that they nicknamed the Nissan HQ building in the Ginza area the Midi of Ginza, meaning that in many ways, Nissan was more about policy and doing what the government wanted rather than actually doing what was best for the company. That swank 16-story building in Ginza was eventually sold off for cash during the crisis period, a symbol of the company's dire straits situation and an opportunity for a revitalizing force from abroad. All right, everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.